Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Well, George, I'll tell you, the bad news is the authoritarian kleptocracy are currently in charge of our government. The good news
the
is
they're idiots.
They're morons. Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. To Sarah, I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain all the illegal news to me. Hey, George.
Hello, Sarah.
George, you and I were together today. We've just been on a little break.
Which is where the way I like it.
It is. And we were in real. We were at Dick Cheney's funeral together, which was a strange and sobering thing.
Yes.
It was my first time at a state funeral. I don't know. Was it yours?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've been to other services, I think, at National Cathedral, but never of a dignitary.
I think part of the reason it was strange, well, there's a few things. One, it was, whatever you think about Dick Cheney and his legacy, there's no doubt that towards the end of his life, he did something pretty unusual. I mean, he endorsed the Democratic nominee for president, Kamala Harris, over the Republican, Donald Trump. And he also was incredibly supportive of his daughter, Liz, who was one of the only Republicans who has done the right thing to speak out and led one of the most robust efforts to actually do something. And so I think you can't deny that a big part of his legacy is that he produced a daughter who has really stood up for America, and that he tried to help her there at the end.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, there were some other things that he did. For example, he and Liz, as I understand it, were instrumental in 2000 in getting together a large group of former secretaries of defense from both parties to say, basically to say that, the military has to not take a position on who won this election. And it was a very, very sobering statement to hear prominent statesmen, former public officials, former Defense Department heads to basically say that, we're in danger here of this guy pulling kind of a military coup. That was the implicit message. And then, as you mentioned, he was also strongly supportive of Liz in 2022. Of course, she won the enmity of MAGA by leading the charge in the January 6th special committee hearings. And then that fall, he cut an ad, which was just an absolute just banger. I mean, he's there looking at the camera in his, his very serious Dick Cheney-like look with his Stetson, and basically said Donald Trump is a danger to the Republic. Full stop. And that's why you should vote for Liz, because Liz believes in democracy and believes in the rule of law. And of course, as we know, that didn't help. And well, it helped something, I guess, but she lost. And then she went back into private life. And then in 2024, as you said, they both endorsed Kamala Harris. And it's really, really quite remarkable, because to see that, the contrast between him and the rest of what became of the conservative movement that really isn't conservative, frankly, is a contrast in character and in the reaction to criticism, if I may. Dick Cheney was vilified during his political career. He was absolutely vilified for any number of things, including and especially the wars in Iran against Iraq and Afghanistan. And to this day, I mean, I just saw people online, liberals calling him a war criminal. And, you know, look, we can debate the Gulf War, right? We can debate the intervention in Afghanistan. And I was critical of the intervention in Iraq as it was happening. I mean, in my private life, murmuring about it to my then wife. But the one thing, even though, you know, there is a question about whether the intelligence about what Saddam was doing with the yellow cake or whatever it was. I remember the presentation of Colin Powell to the UN Security Council.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction, yes. I mean, I think everyone agrees today that the case was overstated, and everyone agrees that the cost of the Iraq war was probably too great, or most people do. Afghanistan, we never really had a plan to get out. We didn't really think about, well, what do we do when we get in? Are we, you know, can we really remake these societies? And there are a lot of reasons to criticize George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and the whole team that did that. But one thing, you know, and you could say maybe they were arrogant and maybe they believed they had unrealistic expectations of how they could remake these societies. And maybe they went overboard on the intelligence in reaction to 9/11. And, you know, maybe they, you know, whatever. You can make these criticisms and you can have a fair debate about them. And I even think George W. Bush has some regrets about how it all played out in hindsight. You know, but you have to say that even the most egregious mistakes that have been made by the United States government in foreign interventions, whether it be the Johnson administration, I mean, even Nixon, and the Bush-Cheney administration, they weren't made because these people wanted to gain favor with foreign dictators or to get narcissistic pleasure out of exercising power or to, you know, for domestic political gain or for all the illegitimate reasons that Donald Trump goes out and threatens allies and makes nice to Saudi butchers and murders people on the high seas. Okay. He was a very, very principled man. And at the end of the day, a lot of the criticisms were very harsh on conservatives generally, conservatives like Cheney and others. I mean, I saw it in the conservative movement as I was getting older. People became very, on the right, became very resentful to the point where they became the very caricatures, and maybe they always were, that liberals made of them. They became every bit as bad as their critics said they were. But not Dick Cheney. Not Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney understood that that wasn't the way you racked. Dick Cheney understood that you're going to get criticized in public life. Dick Cheney understood that, you know, he was trying to help the country and that's what mattered. And yes, maybe, you know, he could accept the criticism. He understood that. And that's why at the end of the day, he did the right thing for his country, for his, you know, and the Constitution in raising this daughter, supporting her, opposing Donald Trump, supporting Kamala Harris, and speaking out about the great danger that the authoritarian right poses to America. And that's just that is just such a difference in character between Cheney and then so many others who worked in Republican administrations in the past. And that's the thing that sort of weighed on me as I watched that funeral. I mean, also, you know, the battle hymn of the Republic makes me cry. along with Ave Maria, but that wasn't a Catholic ceremony. There was one, you know, one other song at the very beginning makes me, you know, the classic funeral songs. I didn't feel mournful for the loss of Dick Cheney. Okay. And I don't mean that out of respect to the Cheney family, I mourn their loss, but you know, he lived to be 84 years old, a man who had a heart attack at age 37 and had a heart transplant 15 years ago, managed to do all these things, coming from a background where he, you know, he had to be made to go back to college by his high school sweetheart, his wife, you know, after he was asked to leave Yale twice, as the story was told today. It was just, we have lost something. We have lost something deeply profound. And what's funny was there was never any mention of Trump or Trumpism. And there was really only one reference that I think Liz made to saying that my father understood, in effect, that she said something like, my father understood that partisan affiliations have to give way to the fact that we are all Americans, that patriotism, country over party. It was like two sentences she worked in there. And that, you know, was encapsulated the difference between people who are inside the cathedral and a lot of these people who were outside the cathedral who didn't come. And that was moving, but there was really no, you know, there was no need to mention Trump. There was very little of this juxtaposition that was direct between the character of this man and his daughter and the complete evil and degradation and depravity of the people who served this administration. And there didn't have to be, because all the eulogies were about duty, honor, integrity, patriotism. And, you know, I'm glad that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance didn't come to this, because they would not have fit in here, because they represent exactly the opposite of the values that were spoken to in the tributes to Vice President Cheney.
You know, I was sitting there trying to sort of grapple with, yeah, Dick Cheney's legacy as a politician. You know, I was so young.
Don't tell me. I can't hear that.
I was in college when 9/11 happened. So, you know, the extent to which.
I was an old man already.
Yeah, but I grew, you know, I came of age sort of in that world.
And you grew up in Central Pennsylvania,
I did grow up in Central Pennsylvania. But the thing that I was sitting there thinking is, I was like, you know, there are a lot of people who obviously feel strongly negatively toward Dick Cheney. And I could sit here, I'm not going to, on the day of his funeral, we could sort of talk about all of the things that we know now about sort of how, I think America has learned a lot in these 25 years or so about
itself and the world.
Yeah. But about how we can, our values, you know, they weren't going to fit everywhere in the world. But that's not the point. The point is, I was trying to think about, as angry as people could be about at sort of Dick Cheney, mm-hmm. And how we might, in retrospect, look back on these decisions and think about them as how wrong they might have been, or if they had just been better handled or whatever. They might have been wrong about their ideas of what was best for America, right? But they were earnest in the sense that they believed that they were the right choices for America. And they didn't set out intentionally to divide us and make us hate each other.
Correct.
And I think that, you know, it's not that Donald Trump makes just like decisions I disagree with. He does that, of course, all the time. It's that I don't think we've ever seen a person, a president of the United States, whose goal is to make us hate each other, whose goal is to see us tear ourselves apart. And that is different. It's a real categorical and moral difference in every president and vice president and administration has to make these incredible choices that end up life and death for people in other countries, for people in America. Like, they're enormous, an enormous weight of history on people. And we try to vote for people that we think are going to make the best decisions. But it used to be that we could vote for people and they might have conflicting senses, conflicting ideas of what was right for America. And you could debate those things, right? And the enormity of them. I don't want to minimize the enormity of them. But you knew that the people that were making them were just taking different positions on like what they thought was best right for us, right? What they thought was the right thing. Right. Whereas Donald Trump, because today is Thursday when we're taping, Donald Trump, before we hopped on, he is currently calling for 8 Democratic former service men and women to be hanged as traitors. They're being called insurrectionists because they cut a video saying, you do not have to follow illegal orders. And I talked to Senator Alyssa Slotkin for the Focus Group podcast. I asked her why they felt the need to make that. And she said, because they're getting so many calls from people in the military who are current service members who are so afraid of what's happening that they felt like they needed to say, if you're asked to do something illegal, you don't have to do it. And so they make this. And now Trump is going after them, like saying that they should be hanged. And it's not the first time like that he has put a public servant in harm's way. And oftentimes will want to say like, oh, you know, no, everything the Republican Party was is in there with the Trump stuff. And that is something I've never quite bought into. You can say the worldview was wrong. You can say the decisions were wrong. You can say they had catastrophic outcomes.
Correct. But and I agree to that with those criticisms to some extent. Yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't.
But they weren't made in. They weren't made for sadistic, sociopathic motivations. They weren't done. I mean, they weren't done to grab power for power's sake. They weren't done to punish political enemies. They weren't done to, you know, murder people for show on the high seas. They weren't done. They weren't, you know, you saw President Trump this week praising MBS and basically saying, well, Khashoggi, nobody liked him anyway. I mean, what the fuck? That's just... it's inhuman. It's indecent. It is condoning vivisection of a political opponent, murder, by slicing him up while he was alive. That's what the Saudis ordered. That's what MBS ordered his people to do. And Trump has no morality, no conscience, no humanity to him. None. He is rank evil. It's just that simple. And it is such a contrast. I mean, it's the difference between, and in the extreme, like good faith and just the worst conceivable worst conceivable bad faith you could imagine.
Yeah. Okay. Before we move on to some stuff about Jeffrey Epstein, I want to take quick break and say that this show is sponsored by Noble Travel. Do you ever think about how easy it is to break into your luggage? I'm on the road all the time and I'm constantly leaving my luggage alone with hotel staff, airline employees, and even in the overhead. That's my passport, iPads, meds, gone before you even land. And if I'm without my iPad, it's pretty much like losing a limb for me, which my producer wrote because it's true. Noble completely removes the zipper. It's a zipperless latch lock suitcase that closes like a safe. The two halves meet with a tight seal. You hear and feel the click when it locks. No more stressing every time your bag's out of sight. If you're like me and always pack your best clothes on vacation, losing that wardrobe would be devastating. Noble isn't just the safest luggage out there. They've actually fixed everything that used to drive us crazy about travel. Their built-in charging port keeps your phone alive at the gate. And don't just take my word for it. Over 500,000 suitcases sold and at the highest rated luggage brand in the category on Trustpilot. Noble's all-in-one carry-on is the durable, safe, advanced luggage you've always dreamed about. Noble gives you real travel peace of mind, security, design, and convenience all in one. For a limited time, Noble is having the biggest sale ever. Head to NobleTravel.com for up to 58% off your entire order. That's NobleTravel.com for up to 58% off. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that we sent you. Thanks, Noble. Well, while we were there, we have continued to see part of the reason that Trump is I think, threatening the lives of these eight Democrats and retweeting people calling for them to be hanged. And he is himself saying that they are traitors and insurrectionists, and, you know, Stephen Miller's out there doing all this. That actually, the reason that Trump grabbing onto this, this little short video that these Democrats made strikes me as Trump trying to change the subject, because he's had a week full of Epstein. It's been all Epstein all the time again. And I want to just remark about how insane it is to think about a guy who is trying to change the conversation about his very close relationship to this pedophile, this notorious pedophile, and giving this sweetheart deal to the other pedophile, Ghislaine Maxwell, who still sits in prison, but a very cushy one now, a club-fed one.
And now has a puppy.
And now has a dog. That's great for her. That Trump is making sure she has a really nice, is serving out her sentence in a cush way. And so he's trying to distract from that by calling for the execution of some Democratic former service members. Like, this is a, this is some next level diabolical, disgraceful stuff.
Beyond that, it's just pure evil. I mean, he basically, what Slotkin and the rest of them were saying is, you know, this is murder that's happening out there on the high seas. These are not combatants. Maybe they're running drugs. They're not running fentanyl to the United States, as far as I've.
How would we know? We're not. How do we know who's on that?
They're just bombing these people without due process, who are not threatening us militarily. And not only that, the one time they bombed a boat, and some people managed to jump off the boat. And they were recovered by either the Navy or the Coast Guard or somebody, by American forces. And guess what? They were repatriated to Venezuela, which tells you they didn't have the basis to arrest them and charge them with the crimes that the government was saying they had the right to murder them for.
Right.
It is absolutely that we are so far beyond a government that is acting legitimately. We are so far beyond a government that is acting in accordance with the rule of law, accordance with international law, in accordance with basic humanity, human decency. It's just stunning. But the good news is that people are waking up to that. I mean, even on immigration, the polls are showing that people are saying this is not right.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's kind of amazing, because the Republicans always had this advantage about immigration. They always had this political advantage on immigration. Of course, you know, they actually won the issue in 2024 with the bipartisan immigration reform bill that everybody, you know, that Joe Biden was ready to sign, and that Senator Lankford was the proponent of. And, you know, he caused that to be killed, not because he thought it was bad for the country, not because he opposed substantively for logical reasons that the reforms were not going to make things better, because he didn't want Joe Biden to get the credit. He wanted the issue to rain in the fire.
That's right.
It's just grotesque and reprehensible, evil, mendacious. I mean, this is not the way human beings should behave, and it's not the way human beings who have, you know, life or death power over so many people and power over so many things should be allowed to act.
So, speaking of mendacious and some of the other words that you said, so Trump signed this bill, right? He signed the Republicans managed to pass the bill to release the Epstein files in the House. The Senate did it, and then Trump signed it. Okay, so he's directing the DOJ to release all unclassified documents about Jeffrey Epstein. And I want to start by saying Trump didn't need Congress to authorize the release of all these files. He could have directed it at any point. But the question I have for you is this. How much should we expect will actually be disclosed? The bill includes exceptions for releasing files, including for active federal investigations and prosecutions. So it feels like the DOJ is going to have a lot of wiggle room in what gets released. What do you think?
Yes. I mean, and you touched upon the central point, which was there was no need for a law. They could have done this months ago, the way they promised to. They could have done it instead of signing this bill. They could have just put the documents out there and said, there's no need to have this bill. They could have preempted the passage of this bill by releasing the documents that are the subject of this bill. And the only reason why it went to his desk and he signed it and he basically gave everyone the green light to vote for it was because he didn't want the embarrassment of losing, even though he was losing big. It was very much like his propensity when he finds out that somebody's going to resign in protest, e.g. John Bolton. He pretends that he was going to fire them or that he fired them first. He wants to basically say, oh, this only happened because I, in my wisdom, decided it should happen. Yeah.
When you're ranting, run out of town, that's right. You jump in front and call it a parade.
That's a great metaphor. When you're being run out of town on a rail, you lead the parade.
Yeah.
And that's what he does instinctively, even though he looks like a jackass and nobody buys it. I mean, his problem was, you know, as soon as the discharge petition, you know, got the 218 votes, whatever it was clear that 100 plus Republicans were going to defect and vote for the bill when it got to the floor. And of course, so the thinking was, let them vote for it. Maybe we can kill it in the Senate. And then it was clear that, you know, and then Chuck Schumer pulled the perfect move. I have to give Chuck credit. He basically said, let's do this on unanimous consent before the bill even gets here. We will deem it passed when it gets here, which was brilliant because the Republicans, nobody wanted to stand up and say, I object to unanimous consent. Nobody wanted to go on record to vote one way against the president or for the president. They just wanted they wanted the thing out of their purview as soon as humanly possible. And so they basically passed it before the papers were even delivered to the House. And then, you know, I thought Trump would take the 10 days. He's entitled to sit on a bill. The presidents are entitled to sit on a bill for 10 days once it's sent over to the White House. If the president doesn't sign it after 10 days, it's deemed to be a pocket veto. If Congress is not in session, or it becomes law if they are in session. So he has 10 days to actually send it back, veto it with a veto message, or sign it. And I thought he would take the 10 days because everything that he has done, and this is where your point comes in about how he could have produced this at any time, including today. The fact that he hasn't shows that he doesn't want to, that there is still something in there that he doesn't want to produce. And it's not even true that apparently that he must think there's something in there that goes beyond what has been released publicly that the House investigators got from the estate of Jeffrey Epstein. But I can't believe there isn't some significant overlap between that and the documents that Blanche and Bondi have. So we have every reason to believe that they are going to do their damnedest, although he did sign it immediately. I thought they were going to take the 10 days. Okay, well, let's put that aside. They're going to look for ways not to produce, to slow this down, even though it's supposed to be done in 30 days, and make it as difficult as possible and avoid producing things. And the way they're going to do that is, okay, so it's the act consists of basically proving it, saying, here's all the stuff you got to produce, Epstein's logs, who was there, whatever. And then there's a second section that says B, prohibited grounds for withholding. No record shall be withheld, delayed, or redacted on the basis of embarrassment, reputational harm, or political sensitivity, including to any government official, public figure, or foreign dignitary. So basically, you cannot withhold this stuff because it is embarrassing to Donald Trump or Bill Clinton or Ehud Barak. Okay. So that's good. So far, so good. But then there's this provision that you alluded to earlier that says C, permitted withholdings. The Attorney General may withhold or redact the segregable portions of records. So if you can carve them out and black them out, you can black out certain parts. One is victims' identities. Okay. Two is things that are actually would constitute child sexual abuse materials under law, that if you sent them to your, you know, to your internet chat chamber or whatever that people do, you'd go to jail for. Okay, fair enough. You black that out or you take it out. I mean, if, well, I'm not going to say anything about Donald Trump maybe being in a picture or something. If it would jeopardize an active federal or investigation or an ongoing prosecution, provided such withholding is narrowly tailored and temporary. And let's put a pin in that proviso there. This is the one that everybody speculates they're going to go to town on. They announced that they're going to investigate Bill Clinton and all the Democrats and all the people they don't like who are, you know, who are mentioned as being on the plane or on an Epstein Island or at the mansion or otherwise appear in these documents. But here's the problem. Okay, you're saying you're going to investigate Bill Clinton, just to pick an example. Okay, it would jeopardize an active federal investigation or ongoing prosecution of Bill Clinton to release materials about Bill Clinton. So you have to withhold stuff. You can't release the stuff relating to Bill Clinton. And on top of that, it wouldn't jeopardize the prosecution of Bill Clinton to release the shit about Trump. So if you are taking this seriously, that the withholding has to be narrowly tailored, this says you have to produce the stuff about Trump and nobody else. So this should not work. Now, I'm not saying they're not going to just misinterpret the statute and pretend it says something it doesn't say, because that's what they do with every other statute they want to evade or violate. And it's also like, you know, that goes back to the other irony that we kind of touched upon. It's like, they didn't need a statute to do this. They don't care in other situations when they're doing shit that they're not authorized to do. They basically say, we have the power to do this even without a statute. But here, they got to have a statute. I mean, come on. And then the other provisions are death, physical abuse, or injury of any person. Okay, so that's probably not going to come into play. It says, the last one is, the Attorney General can withhold stuff that contains information specifically authorized under criteria established by an executive order to be kept secret in the interest of national defense or foreign policy and are in fact properly classified pursuant to such executive order. So
it would be a secret executive order? Would the executive order be public?
I could just imagine him issuing an executive order that certain documents would be withheld because they would harm my ability to be taken seriously in the world or something like that. He could create some crazy executive order. It's not, nothing is beyond these people that basically said, oh, you produce this stuff about me and that's going to hurt the country because I, l'état, c'est moi. So that's kind of where I think we might be headed, the active prosecution, although, that clearly shouldn't help him. And then maybe he'll issue some screwy executive order. Now, the other things that are important in this statute is that it requires some transparency in the decision making to withhold or redact stuff. It requires that they basically publish what they, you know, lists of what they didn't produce. Like kind of like in law, in civil litigation, in criminal litigation, you produce privilege logs. Let's say you have a bunch of documents that are in the files that are relevant, but, you know, they involve communications between someone and their outside counsel. You say, we withheld the following 55 documents. They were from this person to counsel, copying so-and-so. And then you have to put like Ray something. Okay. So they actually have to do something like that. And then they also have to issue a report to Congress explaining those decisions. So there's going to be a lot. If they follow this to the way they're supposed to, there's going to be a lot to say, you know, this is how we do it in civil litigation and how prosecutors do it. You look at the list and you kind of cross check it with the things that you have and the cross check with the things you know, and you say, you know, this one doesn't quite make sense. Judge, we want you to look at that. But I don't know what the mechanism here is to enforce it. But one of the things going to happen is people are going to nitpick whatever information they produce in accordance with this statute about what they've withheld. And if they don't provide the requisite information, they're going to go to town on that. So, and the other problem that they have, regardless of all that, regardless of whether they actually did produce in good faith, which is not possible because they're not possible. They don't act in good faith. Everything under the sun that they actually do have in unredacted form. Okay. In this imaginary world where all of a sudden they do the right thing. No one's going to believe they did that. They have such zero credibility, even among Republicans now. Even, you know, Massey is going to be skeptical of it. MTG is going to be skeptical of it. And a lot of people are going to, you know, I mean, you're going to see if they produce stuff and it doesn't quite seem right in any way, that there should be something else, or it doesn't match up with things we've already seen, or things that should be there logically, given all the other documents, are not there. You're going to see Ro Khanna and Massey basically go to war on that. And that's the problem that they've created by being so mendacious. I will use that word again. It's one of my favorite words to describe Trump and his administration, and dilatory and obnoxious and gaslighting people because they have zero credibility left. And so the problem is, even though this thing has passed, even though he's purported to authorize Congress to pass it, even though he signed it, this thing ain't going away.
This show is sponsored by The Perfect Jean. Life's too short for denim that fights you every step of the way. These jeans move with you, whether you're chasing kids, tackling chores, or just chilling like a boss. Over 400,000 old, young, big, and small men agree, including the ones in my office and the ones on this podcast. One of my producers bought like 6 pairs and gifted one to one of his colleagues. So all my guys out there are wearing them. I endorse a lot of products, but this is one of the small handful that the people around me have genuinely gone truly gaga for. Imagine denim so stretchy, it's yoga ready, sharp enough to turn heads, and comfy enough you'll forget you're wearing them until someone compliments you. The Perfect Jean has 6 fits, a size range from 26 to 50 inch waists, and lengths up to 38, giving you 5,000 plus ways to find your perfect match. For a limited time, our listeners get 50% off their first order, plus free shipping at theperfectjean.nyc, or Google The Perfect Jean and use code AskGeorge15 for 15% off. That's 15% off for new customers at theperfectjean.nyc with promo code AskGeorge15. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. F your khakis and get The Perfect Jean. All right, so before we get to James Comey, which I'm excited to talk to you about, I want to just quickly talk about gerrymandering in Texas. I just interviewed Texas Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher, where we were talking about this. Obviously, there's a lot at stake in the midterms over this, redistricting. And just for people who need just a very brief refresher, Donald Trump instructed the governor there, who is an ally, to do mid-decade redistricting, because what he's trying to do is quickly squeeze out some extra Republican seats because he does not want the oversight of Congress after the midterm. So he was pushing red states to go ahead and redistrict so that they could, all find some extra congressional seats for him. Just do some gerrymandering. The problem was Democrats finally stopped being steamrolled. And in California and in other states, they have been fighting back and doing their own mid-decade redistricting. So, George, without getting into too many details, because the redistricting stuff can get bogged down really fast in all of the details, just run us through what happened when the courts this week, in a 2-1 decision in Texas, said, no, guys, you cannot do this mid-cycle redistricting, and the maps that you have, you're going to have to use them for the 2026 cycle. Is that going to stick? Or, like, just tell me what happened.
I think it's going to stick based upon what I read in this opinion. And I'm going to give you like a 30 to 75 second explanation of what the law is and let me just say, it's a 100,000 foot U2 spy plane level explanation, because if you think too hard about this, your head will spin, not only because the law in some ways is in tension with another, but because the facts are complicated. It's the demographics of a large state that's very, very complicated. There's a lot of math. There's a lot of maps. And basically what the law is this. There is something called the Voting Rights Act, which is passed, was passed by Congress and amended. It was passed in the 60s, amended in 1982, and it enforces 15th Amendments of the Constitution, you know, which prohibit, you know, which guarantee equal protection of the laws and protect voting rights on the basis of race. So what you cannot do is draw districts on the basis of race. And that means two different kinds of things. One is racial gerrymandering. Okay. And I'm going to do this really simplistically. Let's say you have the
You're
case
drawing
of,
pictures. Okay.
This is the state of Allatucky. Nice square.
Yep.
And in the middle of it, there's kind of this urban center and it's got, I don't know, black people. Right?
Sure.
And let's just suppose the district that you have, the districts that you have are just, there are spokes and these are all kind of majority white districts. And this is just the way it's always been, right? Not necessarily racially, but because, you know, this is one kind of, it's contiguous. Okay, this is vote dilution. This is the second thing you can't do. If you decide to basically say, hey, let's create another district and let's basically take in these pieces here, get rid of this one, and basically take all the black people here and put them into these pizza pies so that they're, I don't know, 70% white and 30% black, and we get all white Republican representatives, and we do that because we know where the black people are and we're doing it because of race. That's called vote dilution, intentional vote dilution, intentional discrimination against people on the basis of race. That's illegal. The other thing that is illegal is, let's suppose you have, you know, same kind of a pizza pie kind of thing, and there are maybe more black people there, so that the districts are kind of racially mixed. And you can say, you know, there are too many black Democrats being elected here because there are all these blacks mixed in with all these whites. So let's do something clever. Let's just separate out the blacks into like two districts so we get more white people in more white districts. Again, that's illegal. And the reason why both of those kind of different things going one way and the other are illegal is because you're doing it on the basis of race. It's intentional race discrimination. In 1982, Congress added an effects test, in effect, that was then elaborated upon in a Supreme Court decision interpreting a case called Jingles versus Thornburg. So it must have been during the first Bush administration when we had Attorney General Thornburg, and it said, look, I mean, it's hard to prove intent because people are smart enough not to say, let's move all the blacks into one district. If you do this and you make some other excuse, but it turns out the effect is to basically, you know, dilute. Let's say this is the other side. If you do this with the other one where you basically carve out the blacks and move them around into all the other districts basically make sure that there are fewer black Democratic representatives, and you do that, and it doesn't really appear, you can't tell from the record that there is actually intent because the members of the House and the Senate of the state are smart enough not to say stupid shit on the legislative transcript, you can still violate the new Section 2 as amended in 1982 because the effects indicate discrimination.
They're like, we know what you're doing, guys.
We know what you're doing here because we can see the numbers and we can see the results.
Right.
So again, there is a tension here. You can get in trouble for clumping the minorities into one district, and you can get in trouble for chopping them up and spreading them out, depending on how you do it. And in the case of the vote dilution, chopping them up and spreading them out, they don't even have to show intent, basically. I mean, this is a gross oversimplification. The thing that's really amazing that what happened here is that the federal, the Trumpers, and the state legislators were idiots.
You don't say. That's so unlike them.
The idiots are the state government, whether it was the governor or state legislator, I didn't read it carefully enough, but basically, Harmeet Dhillon, a so-called assistant attorney general for civil rights, wrote a bullshit letter to the state of Texas saying, hey, you've got these districts that have all these mixes of minorities and white people, coalition districts are what they call. Okay. If, you know, again, if you intentionally spread out the minorities, okay, or you dilute them and there's no showing of intent, you can be held that to be illegal. But you have to show that's what they did. You have to show that it was intentional. You have to show that they took steps to make it happen this way. And she writes this letter saying these districts are unconstitutional, even though she didn't cite any evidence for it. I mean, as the district court said, the letter was just so wrong factually and legally, that it was just ridiculous. And even the people who got the letter in the state government said, no, this is bullshit. But what they did was, okay, if these are racially improperly constituted districts, then we've got to basically de-race them or do the reverse racial moving. And that's racial discrimination. They're admitting that they did racial discrimination at the behest of the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, who lied about whether these districts were legal because she claimed that they were racially discriminatory. So they engaged in racial discrimination to undo racial discrimination that nobody really could prove occurred, and there really didn't. And that's illegal. It's no-brainer illegal. And a district court consisting of, and this is an unusual thing, but it sometimes happens in certain kinds of cases in the Voting Rights Act and some constitutional challenges, they have special provisions for this. There was a 3-judge district court where 3 judges essentially act like an appellate panel, but they're hearing the case in the first instance. They hear evidence as 3 judges in a panel, kind of like they do in a lot of foreign countries. And there is always 2 district judges, local judges, and then 1 judge from the Court of Appeals who sits with them. And 2 of the judges held, this is a no-brainer, and they wrote this 160-page majority opinion that is very orderly, very clear, very long, very detailed. But if you read it, you know, it's convincing because it logically sets through the evidence. And the evidence is basically documentary. Every statement in here is supported by a footnote, a letter written by the Department of Justice. I mean, it's a documentary case where you put the documents in chronological order and you can see what they did. And then you can see the maps before and after. And what the legislature of the state of Texas did, as signed by the governor of Texas, is they basically took minorities out of the districts that were identified by Harmeet as the illegal coalition district, and they left all the white districts that they liked alone. I mean, it was the evidence of racial intent is just, I mean, unless there are other facts that have not come to bear, it's pretty compelling. Now, there was a dissent. The author of this opinion was actually a Reagan appointee, Jeffrey V. Brown. And then there was a dissent from a judge who I thought had some respectability. I've met him. I thought, you know, I thought he had a good reputation maybe decades ago. Maybe he, you know, it's just one of those things where you kind of wonder, like, did the guy get red-pilled? Because we see that in politics, and we actually see some judges have gotten red-pilled. I still don't know exactly what that word means, but you taught it to me, and I think it applies here. He wrote this off-the-wall, incoherent, 100-page opinion that is basically disjointed, and a disjointed screed where he even admits up front, oh, I didn't have time to put together this opinion, so it's not organized, which is bullshit because all he had to say is, I dissent for reasons that are coming in a forthcoming opinion. He could have spent some time working on it. But some of the shit that he said is just really not judicial. The resulting dissent is far from a literary masterpiece. He's criticizing his own writing. But if there were a Nobel Prize for fiction, Judge Brown's opinion would be a prime candidate. And then there's another one. He goes, there's the old joke. What's the difference between God and a federal judge? Answer, God doesn't think he's a federal judge. He's basically accusing them of just engaging in judicial activism when all it looks like from the face of the opinion is just they're basically, here are the facts because they are laid out in document one, document two, document three, and here is the law. And the documents show they engaged in racial discrimination. Racial discrimination is illegal. It's, you know, it's long, but it ain't complicated. And then he just, it's like, here's another line from this opinion. I mean, it's like, it's almost psychotic. It's all politics on both sides of the party of the aisle. George and Alex Soros have their hands all over this. What? It was an attack on my friend Mark Elias, because he says, well, Elias has received money from George and Alex Soros. I mean, what the fuck? What does that have to do? The arguments are either right or they're wrong. They're either supported by the evidence and the law or they're not. It was just this bizarre personal attack. And then throughout the opinion, he's attacking the Reagan appointee. I mean, not the Reagan appointee, the Trump appointee.
Sure? He was a Trump appointee, not a Reagan appointee.
Trump, he wrote the majority opinion. This guy was appointed, I don't know, by Reagan or Bush. I don't know who. It is the most bizarre and off-putting and difficult to follow. It's like, I would drug test this judge, frankly, or maybe he's lost it. And I hate to say that, but the opinion is an abomination. It's garbage. It's pure, poorly written. And I am not, by saying that, saying that there might not been an alternative side of the story that is coherent and plausible and arguable, or maybe even right. I just want to see what that legal argument is and what the facts are that were not necessarily in this opinion, because the two judges didn't think it was important and this one did. I want to know. I want to see both sides. I mean, usually if somebody's doing a good job of legal writing, whether it's a brief or a majority opinion, you should finish reading that opinion saying, oh, that makes sense. I get it. And then, but you always have to read the dissent or the opposing brief to say, you know, maybe there's something else to it. And and the object is, when you read both sides of the brief, if litigators or judges do their jobs, you should be able to read each one alone and saying, wow, they have a good argument. And then you have to really think it through and just say, okay, let's go through this one by one and who's right on each point and develop your own opinion about it. And Judge Smith's insane dissent, you read it and you're just like, this is a screed. It seems overwrought. It's hard to follow logically. I don't know what purpose it served. And it's just a weird, weird thing. But it tells me something interesting. It's like, look, who knows what the Fifth Circuit's going to do? Actually, no. With a three-judge panel, it goes straight up to the Supreme Court. They skip the Court of Appeals. That's one of the reasons why they have a three-judge panel. I don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do with it, but I just would leave this alone. Which is kind of interesting, because then, you know, it completely, you know, if this is invalidated, then you've got California doing what it does. And maybe that'll get struck down for other reasons. I don't know. I don't know exactly. I haven't looked at those maps and I haven't looked at the briefs and the challenges to the California thing. And, you know, if it turns out everybody's redistricting gets struck down, I guess it's a wash. On the other hand, there's an argument.
Which is fine. Gerrymandering is bad.
Gerrymandering is a bit in the eye of the beholder, but, it's just like, the more people play games with these districts, the less people trust the democracy.
That's right.
And it's like, it's important that state legislatures and governors exercise self-restraint.
Yeah. But you cannot have Democrats, you know, unilaterally disarm on this fight.
That.
And so anyway, I got to move us on. Although I will just note, that as a metric of time, if that was a George Conway 75 seconds, You know, it's like a Scaramucci or something. That's just, except it's like longer instead of shorter.
Well, it's 75 seconds compared to like you could do a semester long college seminar on this.
Sure,
shit.
Totally.
I mean, not college, law school seminar, and so that's all the right. best I could do to summarize. I think it makes you know, you can understand it basically at a high level.
Yep, very good. Okay. This show is sponsored by Factor. Fall always feels like a reset between back to school, busier routines, and shorter days. Finding time to cook can be tough. It's impossible for me. That's why I love Factor. Their chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals make it easy to stay on track and enjoy something comforting and delicious, no matter how hectic the season gets. Choose from a wider selection of weekly meal options, including premium seafood choices like salmon and shrimp, at no extra cost. Enjoy even more GLP-1 friendly meals and a new Mediterranean diet option packed with protein and good for you fats. For the first time, try Asian inspired meals with bold flavors influenced by China, Thailand, and more. From more choices to better nutrition. That's why 97% of customers say that Factor helped them live a healthier life. Feel the difference no matter your routine. Eat smart at factormeals.com/askgeorge50off and use code askgeorge50off to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code askgeorge50off at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for 1 year. Get delicious ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription for purchase. George, hello. Before we wrap here, okay. I wanted to quickly, two Scaramucci's, I want to talk
half
about...
half a Scaramucci. Okay, two things happened this week. One is a federal magistrate judge who was charged with dealing with Comey's motion to basically have the record of the grand jury produced in its entirety because they are suggesting that there was misconduct committed by Lindsay, the incompetent and inexperienced Lindsay Halligan, before the grand jury. The judge basically agreed that there was a substantial reason to believe that the government had engaged in misconduct, including, for example, telling a grand jury, which you are not supposed to do, that, hey, don't worry if you haven't seen all the evidence you think we need to have. I'm paraphrasing in a tendentious way, because we're going to have more at trial. We can get this guy. You can't do that. What you have to do is you have to show the jury the evidence that you think amounts to probable cause to support an indictment, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, probable cause, more likely than not that something happened here and that the defendant did it. And you have to do that on the basis of the evidence that they see, and they have to find that. Okay? You can't just say, hey, there's more stuff, don't worry about it. And there were a couple of other things that seem to have been possibly gone wrong in that she did wrong that would have been improper, but we need to see the whole transcript. And the other thing turns out to be, you remember how we talked about how there were like two indictments? There was one that came that was like a no bill, that had a no bill on one of the charges. And then there was one that was, they stripped out the charge that there was a no bill on, and they just had the two charges. And the third one that they took out was the one where they didn't have a majority of the, I guess, 23 or 24 grand jurors. It turns out the defense became suspicious that what happened was the grand jury voted on two or three charges and said, we don't like the last one. And instead of going back to the word processor and deleting the third count from the document while you keep the grand jury in the room so that then you can go back with the revised indictment that has the voted down count removed, and you hand the copies to the indictment and you to the jurors, and they vote on it and they approve it. And that's the one that the foreman signs, and that's the one that the prosecutor signs, and that's the one that goes into court. The suspicion was that she didn't do it that way. After they voted on the thing that had the indictment that had the draft indictment that had one of the charges rejected, she went and retyped it and only presented it to the foreman, had the foreman sign it, and she signed it. The grand jury didn't see it. And that is like, you talk to a prosecutor, it's like, what the? No, you have to present it. It's like presenting somebody's tax returns. You send it back to your accountant and say, I don't think this is right. can you rerun that so it's accurate and I don't go to jail? You're supposed to go look at it again. You're supposed to give the document. And it's true with any revised legal document. Even if you know that even if you trust the person who's revising the document, so all we did was take out part three, the one that we didn't like. But they have to see it. And then they have to vote on it. Because if they didn't, they didn't actually vote on the indictment that was returned to the court. And so this is a problem. And it's unclear what the remedy is, but it's hard to, I don't see how you can say this is a legitimate indictment if it wasn't actually approved by the grand jury. And as we've discussed, the statute of limitations ran a few days after that, and that bullshit indictment that was presented by a U.S. attorney who wasn't properly appointed, and that the grand jury never saw the indictment and has bogus charges in it anyway. They can't fix it. The statute of limitations is run. So there are so many problems. I mean, this case is like, you know, the Titanic had one gash between like the third and fourth compartment and like the fifth or sixth. There's too many to allow it to hold water for more than a couple of hours. This thing's got Swiss cheese holes on both sides. This thing is going down. The SS Comey indictment is going down one way or the other. And it may sink all at once evenly, because I think what might could happen is the judge who has the appointment part of the case could say this wasn't properly presented by someone who is a properly appointed U.S. attorney. And Nachmanoff, the judge who has the main case in the Eastern District of Virginia, could say, okay, I've looked through all this stuff that the magistrate judge is ordered to produce, that you do to produce, and I'm ordering you to produce it, and I've now looked at it. Not only was the conduct improper because you told the grand jury, you misstated the law to grand jury, not only did you not have the authority to present anything to the grand jury as per the other judge, not only did you fail to actually present the grand jury with the whole document, and not only does the whole document not make any sense on the merits. I mean, you could see an opinion being written down, and I think the judge wants to decide this in the next few weeks, maybe before Thanksgiving or right after Thanksgiving, I forget, where this whole thing gets shot down with so many holes, it's never going to fly again.
Well, George, I'll tell you, the bad news is the authoritarian kleptocracy are currently in charge of our government. The good news is
they're idiots.
They're morons. They are morons.
Complete morons. They really are.
So that's
they really are.
All right, George. As always, thanks for talking.
They're dangerous morons, though.
True. I know it. But you know, it makes one feel at least a little better that when they try to go after you, they're totally incompetent in doing so.
Yeah.
Okay, George, thanks as always for talking about the illegal news with me. Guys, don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and we will see you next week.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell them well about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the Emoluments to the Russian ties. Oh, Sarah, listen close.